Welcome to El Paso Primetime. Information for everyone, especially those who live in the third age.
This is the town and these are the people. This is the town where the people all stay. This is the town and these are the people. That's the way they wanted it. That's the way it's going to stay.
Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. Due to circumstances beyond our control, the live call-in show with the tummy doctor, Dr. Richard McCallum, has been rescheduled to next Saturday at 1 p.m. Hold those questions until then. But right now, as you well know from last night, the monsoon season has arrived. And joining us on El Paso Primetime is John Fawcett, a good friend to the radio station, great friend in the community. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Welcome to El Paso Primetime, young man.
Well, thanks for having me, young man. I turned 60 a week or two ago.
It's okay. I turned 63 weeks ago, so we're good.
Oh, you beat me. Okay.
What's time between friends? But we're in the midst of what we're heading into, monsoon season.
That's correct. The North American monsoon. It's a real thing. It's centered more in Mexico, but the heating of the plateau in Mexico draws in moisture from oceans on either side, tropical moisture, subtropical moisture. And then once the pattern sets up over the United States, upper level high, clockwise flows tends to draw up that moisture, mainly into the desert southwest. But it can go as far away as the Canadian border.
Yeah. The jet stream is something that I like to play around with. I like to see what that does, because in the wintertime, I notice that when that thing comes down beyond our area, it really brings that cold shelf in from Calgary and all mm-hmm. that other stuff. But what does it do in the summertime?
In the summertime, it takes a Canadian vacation. It's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you do have the jet stream in the area, when also you have the warmer temperatures and moisture, that gives us our occasional severe weather episode, because the jet stream means there's going to be increasing winds the higher you go up, and often a directional change the higher you go up. That can lead to thunderstorms that rotate around a rotating updraft. Basically, what that means is the storm is going to be stronger. It's probably going to give you large hail and a slight chance of a tornado, that kind of thing. We've seen that already a couple of times this spring. But if you have the jet stream hanging around a little longer than it's supposed to, you get more of those chances into early summer. And guess what? We have an El Nino episode in effect right now, and it's strengthening. And the El Nino tends to keep the jet stream further south and active. We would like to see what it's going to do this summer. Usually, there's not a connection between El Nino episodes and the summer monsoon. This will be a great opportunity to see what's going to happen, because during El Nino, your Pacific temperatures, sea surface temperatures are warmer than normal. That means more hurricanes than normal.
Mm.
I've already had Andres and Blanca. And if you have more hurricanes than normal, you have maybe a higher chance, a bigger sample to choose from to get one to curve up. And even though it's not a hurricane anymore, the remnants, think back to last September,
sure,
the remnants of Odile. Maybe you have a better chance of that happening again this summer. It's going to be interesting to see.
A pedestrian question. What's the difference between a hurricane and a typhoon?
Same animal. They're both tropical cyclones that reach a certain intensity, start out as a circulation, then a tropical depression, then it gets a number, not a name, but a number. And then if it strengthens further, it becomes a tropical storm, gets a name. There are six regions in the world where these tropical cyclones frequent, and there are six areas that have a pot of names to choose from. They're determined for years in advance. And so we have the East Pacific here, and on the other side, you've got what most of the United States is familiar with, the Atlantic Basin, which has the Gulf of Mexico and Caribbean. So, but you've got typhoons. They call these tropical cyclones typhoons once you get out into the central or especially the western Pacific. And they call them cyclones, just a very general term. A cyclone is a low-pressure system. But in the Indian Ocean, they call them cyclones.
Okay. Well, that brings me back to something that I always remembered from grade school about a cyclone being in the Midwest. Now, what's a cyclone, a tornado? You've got the little dust devils.
Right, right. See, my grandmother, you know, and my kinfolk in the panhandle of Texan, they would call tornadoes cyclones. People in the Indian Ocean are calling hurricanes cyclones. Well, you know, they're both right because cyclone is a low-pressure area. Mm-hmm. But cyclone is the big generic term, and then there's specific names for different types in terms of size, magnitude. Generally, when we talk about an extratropical cyclone, it's a low-pressure area coming along the jet stream off the Pacific.
Okay.
When we talk about a tropical cyclone, totally different formation. They can become hurricanes or whatever you want to call them, typhoons. And then you have your dust devil, very small scale. And they're so small, they last for such a brief period of time that they can rotate in either any direction. It's not determined by the rotation of the Earth. And then if you get a dust devil that moves under a growing thunderstorm, thunderstorms have updrafts that grow the storm. If a dust devil gets caught in that, it can stretch and stretch and reach the base of the storm, and then we have to call it a tornado by definition, a landspout tornado. They're weaker in general, but so there's all kinds of things when you start bringing up, like you did, cyclones or low pressure areas. Many, many different twists.
John, how did you get involved in meteorology in the first place? This is really a fascinating topic for me, but you know, everybody keeps ragging on me because I love weather.
Well, the interesting thing is, and you should listen to various people to see how they get interested in weather and become meteorologists. Mm-hmm. Mine is on one extreme. When I was 2.5, 3 years old, as far back as I can remember, I grew up in Long Beach, California. Very, very few thunderstorms. And I was frightened. I heard this thunder. I didn't know what it was. But at the same time I was frightened, I got hooked. I got interested. Even though, you know, through my grade school years, man, I'd hide under the covers. I'd be afraid of this lightning and thunder, but I loved it. What a weird lifestyle. Well, I kicked the fear when I was in high school, maybe too far, because I started doing too foolish type things that I preach against right now. Regarding lightning, it just grew and grew, and then my mom said, well, you need to get your degree in meteorology. Okay.
Gotta love that.
Yeah. Well, she had a love of nature and music, and I kind of absorbed both of those.
A lot of our listeners don't understand the complexity of getting a meteorological saying that.
A degree in meteorology.
Right. That.
Yeah.
If I can't pronounce it, why do I want to study it? But I do.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a lot of complexity involved in it. Physics and
math. Lots of math.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we have a person volunteering with us this summer who goes to UTEP, sitting over there to the side. And he is experiencing this right now. Lots of math. He's getting his degree in physics, and UTEP doesn't offer a degree in meteorology, but he'll probably get his master's degree at somewhere like University of Oklahoma if he doesn't get killed by a tornado. No. Anyway, so he's in the thick of it right now, but meteorology does require lots of math. You have to be able to understand the processes of the atmosphere, and to be able to do that, it takes mathematics and physics. Now, once you understand those concepts, you probably don't use much of that math anymore. Lots of sciences are like that, but you needed it to be able to grasp and for a lifetime, be able to deal with these physical processes that we use in meteorology.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me because, you know, even in liberal arts, when you're getting a degree, like say in communication study, you still have to study quantitative analysis in order to quantify why, mm-hmm. a certain phenomenon. And then afterwards, once you get the grasp of all that, then you just know how to study it
right.
and how to go on with it. So, yeah, I get that.
That's if you're going to be an operational meteorologist like myself involved in forecasting and that type. That's what most people think of.
Mm-hmm.
No, we have research meteorologists. They don't forget their math. They keep it right at hand to help develop better theories and equations and ways to describe the atmosphere. We need those guys.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. There's one guy at our office, I don't know why, but he's never forgotten his math. He's a tutor in math, and he applies meteorological equations to things like trains going by the office. So I guess it has a it has its pull, but I always thought that if you're really into math, you must have been a problem child.
Mm.
No, never mind. Okay.
Well, see, but I do understand the reason why you have to have the math. You know, God love them. We had this guy over at Channel 4, Jim Gamble. You know him very well. And Jimmy had this real unusual love of trying to figure out how many millibars.
Mm-hmm.
before going on air so that he could do the proper mm-hmm. barometric pressure. And I was always fascinated by that whole thing.
You know, one thing about Jim Gamble, I remember bringing him in to the TV world in the early 80s. This guy, I had a lot of respect for him because he would just, to time it kind of like, oh, gosh, get off my back, because he would just be asking. He didn't have his meteorology degree, so he would ask and ask the meteorologist, gaining this knowledge all the time. So I leave, go to the National Weather Service, and come back to town 8 years later, and, you know, he's, you know, prime time, and he has been doing the same thing to my coworkers of the National Weather Service, but they appreciated that guy, and he never called himself a meteorologist. That's rare nowadays. You know, nowadays if you have a correspondence degree from, you know, Mississippi State, you can call yourself a meteorologist. But for the National Weather Service standards, and that's how Jim always went, now you need your full degree. Yeah, bless Jim's heart. He had a big impact on this community.
And still does. He's one of my mentors, as you are, in trying to determine how best to tell our audience about the weather.
Yes, communicating it to the audience. There is an art there, and I appreciate a lot of the folks we have in town right now. They're very good at that, and that's why National Weather Service partners with the media very much, because they get our word out to the public still at this day and age better than anyone else. And so, you know, we like to have that type of partnership.
We're all community. What can
yes,
I tell you?
That's right. And your media.
Yeah.
To an extent.
To a point.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've been only a couple of months into this business, so we'll figure it out.
Boy, you seem like an expert.
It's smoke and mirrors. John, you have to come back, and we, as we get further and further into the monsoon season, if things start getting a little dire,
mm-hmm.
we need to start talking about all kinds of other things that come along with that whole process.
Oh, absolutely. Lightning safety, when thunder roars, go indoors, flash flooding, which we have plenty of,
mm-hmm.
turn around, don't drown, all kinds of damaging downbursts, Monsoon Awareness Week. We do every year, probably just finished,
mm-hmm.
and we will continue that. We don't leave it with that week.
Right.
We're available for the rest of the summer and early fall when you encounter these threats.
Let's look at the last week in July. Bring you back. Let's start talking about what to expect heading into the fall.
Okay.
Time.
We'll figure out a time. Yeah, I'm mm-hmm. working shifts all summer. These forecasters, they want to go on vacation for some reason.
Yeah, what is up with that
and
vacation?
Here I am in management thinking, why do you guys want a vacation? Bless their hearts. They're awesome guys at the Weather Service office here.
Absolutely. You're absolutely drop dead wonderful. Thank you so much for all you do.
Well, thank you.
And El Paso Primetime returns in just a moment. On the phone with me this afternoon is Ra Goddess. Oh, my goodness gracious, I am so happy to have you on the radio here in El Paso, Texas.
Oh, Dennis, it's my privilege, my privilege. Thank you so much for having me.
Let me ask you right off the bat, the difference between being a life coach that some people are in their careers, and you who are an entrepreneurial soul coach. You founded and you're the CEO of Move the Crowd, but more so you're a soul coach. And that tells me volumes about where you go with people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that question. This is the first time I've had this question, so I'm so thrilled. For me, I believe that the entrepreneurial journey is a soul journey, and it's something that I don't feel like is necessarily talked a lot about, but I know I'm speaking to all of my business owners out there, big and small. When you're growing a business or building a business, it requires every facet of your being to support the success and to sustain the success of the business. And so as much as when we think about entrepreneurial training, we think about the nuts and bolts, right? We think about the marketing and the sales, right? And all of those sort of aspects, which are important, very, very important. But we don't necessarily talk as much about the internal journey and the way that the personal growth and development contributes to the success of the business. And so one of the things that I learned early on in my own journey was that it was so important to work on the inside as much as it was important to build the knowledge and the skills and the relationship. So, yeah.
Yeah, you started your own hip-hop record company at a time when the music business was a little bit in flux. They didn't know where they wanted to go with digital. Should we stay with vinyl? We got to move on with compact disc. You know, and things were just happening just right and left. And you stuck to your guns and went into this whole business of hip-hop and making sure that your record company was going to be run the way you saw it in a vision, right?
Yeah, and I was going to say just that, Dennis. I had a vision about the kind of music I wanted to create, about the kinds of community I wanted to engage through the music, about the kinds of issues I wanted to talk about. And, you know, I don't need to tell you, but, you know, the sort of, especially at the time when I was up and coming as an artist, the opportunities for mainstream women in hip-hop were very limited. It was kind of like, if you like sequins and very little clothing, then you might be okay. But if you were, you know, sort of wanting to come with a message and wanting to transform communities and heal and bring upliftment and empowerment, it wasn't necessarily the kind of thing that the commercial market was receptive to. And, you know, of course, I thank God for pioneers like, you know, Lauryn Hill and sort of the way that I think she began to sort of tip the conversation, but, you know, she occurred, I think, to the industry as more of an anomaly than anything else. And, you know, so in that time, it was really important to be able to create other alternatives to have our music heard. And so as somebody who is a devotee of the culture of hip-hop and was raised in the culture of hip-hop as opposed to sort of the commercial industry of hip-hop, it was important to be able to have that vehicle and, you know, and create that space where the kind of music that I felt like I wanted to make was possible and viable. You know, and you know it's a whole different game today. I mean, it's incredible what independent artists are able to do today with, you know, sort of the advent of all of the platforms. But back then, you're right, it was, you know, tough slog, but worth it, very much worth it.
You know, and there's something that you just touched on that I think a lot of people in mainstream society forget, that there is a culture of hip-hop. It's not just about the music, but there is the culture that's steeped in the tradition that goes all the way back, I mean, centuries, if you really wanted to break it down.
Yes, absolutely true. Absolutely true. You know, this commitment to knowledge and upliftment and empowerment and originality and artistry and creativity from the perspective of what really strengthens communities is the lineage of the culture. And it's, you know, it's so important, I think, for us to realize that, you know, what we see in any aspect of commercial market retail world does not necessarily represent the total of whatever that culture or that industry is, right?
Absolutely. Now, one of the things I wanted to come back to is the whole movement, so to speak, about Move the Crowd. It's such a great little concept, it's huge, quite frankly. It really is, because what you're doing is you're empowering generations now on knowing how to market themselves, but also knowing how to find inner peace while they go for the brass ring.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, when I began to think about why I wanted to do this and why I wanted to embark on Move the Crowd and the way that we wanted to create it, you know, you're absolutely right. For me, we are a movement. You know, we have a commitment to serving 1 million entrepreneurs within the context of this commitment to stay true, get paid, do good. We are also a community of practice. There's sort of a number of ways we sort of speak ourselves, but the commitment is to create a new paradigm of how we do business. And it is to transform what we've known as being the traditional culture of capitalism from something that has felt in many ways elitist and disproportionate to something that is much more equitable, much more accessible, and much more sustainable. We are very much interested in a world where more of us can thrive. And that's really the impetus for the company and the commitment, so that people have the opportunity to feel their own agency and to be inspired by their own dreams and aspirations, and also to celebrate the multifacetedness that they are. You know, we say whole self to the party, because we know that what it takes to really have genuine success and what it really takes to embody and create the vision that we all want to have and see in the world, it requires, you know, all of who we are to be present and fully engaged.
One of the things that you engage entrepreneurs with now is something that should have been done a long time ago, and yet it kind of lacks in from generation to generation, and that's the notion of social change.
Mm-hmm. It is a prerequisite for us. You know, we are about contribution, and that is really the center of what we hold as the core foundation for what we're most interested in. We are interested in supporting people who know that they have a contribution to make. Now, we feel that all of us do, right? But there are ways in which, unfortunately, some of us have not felt empowered to, or well supported even, right, Dennis, to make the contribution that we're here to make. And we talk to entrepreneurs every day who are struggling with trying to manage paying the bills and caring for the family with this dream or this aspiration that they have. And our feeling is that if you really are committed to making the world a better place, that you deserve to be supported. And you deserve to have a structure and a framework that can give you the knowledge, the tools, and the skills that you need in order to have that contribution thrive. And so that's our commitment. And like I said, for us, wanting to make the world better, a better place, is something that we all ought to be invested in.
Yeah.
Right? Given what we're experiencing right now. And, you know, and I know I don't need to tell you all of the ways that we are sort of pushing the edges of the front lines of civic participation right now because of the ways that systems and structures of inequity have just gone, you know, so far off the rails. You know, we are in what I call the age of the citizen, which is really about how we're supporting people and being able to make their highest contribution and their own brand of contribution, which is, you know, different from the age of celebrity, which is where we've been, which has been all about iconic worship and elitism and success only belonging to a few people. This commitment to social impact is about a vision where all of us can thrive.
This is one of those moments that now I can sit and compare the difference between academic mentorship and soul coaching. It's so intimate. It's almost a one-on-one kind of a journey that you take a person from being who that person is at that moment and then take them to the next level so they understand that all their actions, everything they do, is going to lead to something a lot better for their lives, but also for the people around them.
Yes. You want to thrive. You want to truly thrive. Focus on impact. We have seen it time and time again. If you really focus on being of service and of highest service, being of kind,
yeah, still here.
A recipe for success.
Mm-hmm. You took a rather unconventional way to get to where you're at now, where you're internationally acclaimed. But when you very first started this road, I mean, weren't you just as an undergraduate at Vassar trying to figure out exactly where you wanted to go?
Interesting. I think about Sheryl Sandberg's quote about, you know, her career trajectory not being a ladder, but rather being a jungle gym.
Mm-hmm.
and I would say that I agree. I would say it's interesting, Dennis, in that, you know, if we really sit down and have those conversations straight line. And thank God for that, because there's something about what we learn in every environment. So my years in corporate, my years in hip-hop, my years in frontline community engagement and activism and transformation, my years in international engagement and activism, those are all of the things that I draw vision. And the multifacetedness is, I humbly say, what helps me be a great coach. You know, because to your point, you know, when someone is nurturing a dream, that's sacred space. You know, it's like nurturing a child. It's sacred space. It's holy ground. And it is intimate because you're getting into this and creating a space where they can speak the most truest and the most highest expression of themselves and then actually develop a strategy and a plan to achieve that and to reach that. And, you know, I can't think of a better job to have, except maybe yours, Dennis, because you just get to talk to everybody.
Well, so do you.
But you know, but I have to say that every facet of my journey has served me. Every facet of my journey has served me, and I'm thankful, deeply thankful, for the road that I've traveled, as crooked as it's been.
Ra Goddess, thank you so much for being on this episode of El Paso Primetime. I'm very honored that we were able to latch up. And I'd love for you to come back to the show periodically so we can talk more about this, because this is really, really interesting. And you're such a lovely person.
Oh, Dennis, thank you so much. It's been my honor, my privilege, and a big shout out to El Paso.
Yay.
All that you do.
Oh,
and all that you are.
Bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Ra Goddess is an internationally known life coach, actually a soul coach. Her website is movethecrowd.me, and you can find Ra, R-H-A, on Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn. Earlier, we spoke with meteorologist John Fawcett. You can reach him via the local National Weather Service website at srh.noaa.gov. Ongoing at Oscarity Park is the third annual El Paso Mud Music Festival, with Billy Towns and Crunch being part of the lineup this afternoon. The Isleta Mission Festival is also on for tonight and tomorrow, 131 South Zaragoza at Alameda. Viva El Paso is scheduled for a performance tonight at the McKilligan Canyon Amphitheater. Dancing in the City continues tonight at the Convention Center Plaza downtown with a 7 p.m. dance lesson, followed at 8 by Everyday People. And the Big Band Sound returns with the Paso del Norte Big Band presenting a Sunday in the 40s at the Women's Club of El Paso tomorrow afternoon from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. It's BYOB. Music Under the Stars features Vertical Horizon tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Chamazal National Amphitheater. Deidre Westenhauser is the series executive producer. She recorded and edited today's episode. Next week, we hope to reschedule a live show featuring the tummy doctor, Dr. Richard McCallum, and co-host Noemi Rojas. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. I hope you enjoyed this episode of El Paso Primetime. I'm going to go to the hospital.